very warm Croydon welcome to the guest speaker for the 1994 Charles John Galt Memorial Lecture, Sir Bernie Grant.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and can I thank yourselves and the organisers of this event for inviting me to Croydon to address you on the issue of the rise in racism in Britain. I think it's a great privilege to be able to address such an august gathering, and indeed to speak and to give the memorial lecture for Charles John Cobb. We have heard of Mr. Cobb and the fact that he was sentenced to 4 years hard labor for being a conscientious objector. And I think that there are those of us who are currently in Parliament who, whilst not being quite conscientious objectors, certainly object most vehemently to the whole way in which the country is being governed at the moment. And I know that some of my distinguished predecessors, like Arthur Scargill and Jeremy Corbyn, indeed, would agree with me that it is important that we celebrate and that we speak about people like Charles John Cobb. Because, of course, unless we do so, such heroes are likely in today's world, with all the distractions that are around us, unless we constantly remind ourselves of the struggles of those heroes and heroines in the past, they are likely to be forgotten in this world. Now, when I agreed to speak at the lecture, it was arranged last year, I asked Jeremy Corbyn, who is my colleague within the Socialist Campaign Group of Labour MPs, what the audience was like, because I wanted to be at least a bit prepared. And he said, oh, well, they are very good people. He said, there are people there who are, some are socialists, working class people, people you feel at home with. And I have to say that my welcome so far has confirmed what Jeremy has been saying. And I hope that I will do justice to the memory of Mr. Cobb in what I have to say this evening. I am not a pacifist. And, but I could understand why it is that particularly in the First World War and the Second World War, why people objected to going to war to fight to kill their fellow human beings. I could well understand it. And I know that the war that we witnessed a few years ago, the Gulf War, was a war that would not get the support of a large number of people. And it didn't get the support of a large number of people. That war wasn't supported because a number of us felt that that war was the first of the neo-colonialist and the neo-imperialist wars that we expect to be fought over the next period. A number of us felt that there is a new world order in the offing, particularly with the end of the Cold War. And some 50 of us in the House of Commons, all Labour MPs, registered our objections to the Gulf War because we felt at that time that it was a racist war. We felt at that time that it was a war about oil, that it was a war that where the countries of the North, the countries of the West, wanted to show and demonstrate to the world at large that they had huge arsenals, that they were able to pick off a fly at 2,000 feet. And a number of us felt that we could not, in all conscience, go along with such a war, particularly the bombing of innocent civilians in Baghdad and Basra and in other parts of Iraq. We couldn't support that. And some of us were vilified. They called us the Dirty 30 at one stage. And we said, well, that's fine. You know, we don't mind what you call us, but we're not prepared to have the blood of Iraqi citizens on our hands. We had no sympathy, of course, for the likes of Saddam Hussein. And we said that he should be dealt with in a different manner. But to bomb consistently, more bombs were dropped on Iraq, some 200,000 tons of bombs dropped on Iraq, more than the Second World War, and indeed the First World War, of course. That could not be justified, we believe, in today's world. So we're not conscientious objectors, necessarily, but certainly we felt that that war couldn't be justified. And I mentioned the question of the Iraq War, because two of the themes that we are talking about this evening, the question of pacifism, being a conscientious objector, and the question of racism, all of that was contained within that Iraq war. And I think that when we move on to talk about racism per se, and racism in Britain, I think that we have to start off by saying, first of all, that racism in Britain is not a new phenomenon. That as far back as the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, she issued a proclamation banishing all blackamoors from the lands of Britain and calling on people to drive these blackamoors out of Britain. So that there is a historic precedent for the struggles against racism in Britain. And when we look at the position in Britain today, when we look at racism, I think it's important for us to look at it in the context of what happened traditionally or what has happened historically in Britain, and also to look at it in the context of the world situation, because Britain is no longer going to be an island. We're going to be connected by at least the Channel Tunnel, if it ever gets on the road or on the rails. And we are no longer going to be a country where we could afford to bury our heads in the sand and not have any truck with what's happening in the rest of the world. Indeed, the moves over the past year in Commons over the Maastricht Treaty and the new Treaty of Union, the British citizens becoming European citizens for the first time ever, I believe that this whole change changes our relationship with the world at large. So that my discussion tonight, or my talk tonight, will refer to what's happening around the world. And I want to start off by saying that at the end of next month, we will be seeing one of the most remarkable events, I believe, in the history of the world, and that would be the inauguration of Nelson Mandela as president of a new democratic South Africa. I was in South Africa last year at the invitation of the African National Congress to discuss with them the ramifications of the election. And they made it clear to me, and I made it quite clear to them, that the role of South Africa is going to be one of the most important roles of any country in the whole of Africa and indeed in the black world. Because, of course, the transformation that has taken place over the past 10 years has really got to be seen to be believed. And I put a lot of it down to the struggles, not only of the ANC, but the support that it had in this country through people refusing to have any truck with apartheid, with sanctions that the whole world laid on South Africa, and of course the physical struggles, the armed struggles of the people of South Africa and the people of Namibia. And of course, in this context, one has to mention one of the countries in the world that played a leading part in the military struggles of the South African people, and that country, of course, is Cuba. And with the Battle of Quito Coulibaly, when the Cubans and the Namibians put around the South African forces, I believe at that particular stage in history, we began to see a whole shift in the relationships between the people of South Africa and the leadership in South Africa. And we began to see a move towards this position now where on the 27th of April, we've got elections in South Africa. Now, I think that the whole South African situation is very important. I think it is important, apart from everything else, because the new regime in South Africa will have the responsibility of knitting together a country that has been divided clearly on the basis of race. It is one of the last countries in the world where this has happened. And once we get over that hurdle, then I believe we will be moving into a whole new era. So I certainly welcome the 27th of April or the 28th of April when we will have a new government in South Africa. South Africa has been a symbol to people of African origin and to other people who have been involved in liberation struggles the world over. And that is very important. I believe that we are in a climate today within the world that is not as hopeful as the situation in South Africa is. I believe that throughout the world we have seen a change in the relationships that is making it ever more difficult for ordinary people, particularly in third world countries, in black countries in the south, particularly in those countries, to exist in any reasonable manner. We have seen the New World Order. And what the New World Order has done is that it has begun to divide up the world into three major trading, economic, and political blocks. The block in the Far East around China and Japan, with Taiwan going back to China, Hong Kong going back to China, Macau going back to China, with all the moves around Japan, Korea, Indonesia, Malaysia, the whole Pacific Rim of countries, will form a massive trading and probably the richest economic bloc in the world in the future. We have a bloc in the Americas, around the North America Free Trade Agreement, with the United States, Mexico, and Canada forming another major economic and monetary bloc. And we are hopeful that perhaps that could be extended to take on board the struggling peoples of Latin America and the Caribbean. And we have a third bloc right here in Europe, the European Union. We started off by calling itself the European Economic, the European Common Market. Then it changed to European Economic Community, the EEC. And now it is the EU, European Union. And we don't know what it will be next year. But you can rest assured it will change its name again. And we have that bloc, which is going also to be eventually a massive military bloc, a massive economic bloc, and a massive political bloc. And we're talking about the European Union, which will take on board not only the 12 countries that are currently in the Union and the other countries of the European Free Trade Area, but we're talking about taking on board the countries of the old Soviet Empire, the countries in Eastern and Central Europe, Czechoslovakia. We're talking about countries like Romania, Poland, and in the old Soviet Union, we are talking, of course, not about the entire ex-Soviet Union countries, but we're talking about the white countries. We're talking about Russia and Belarus and Georgia. But we're not talking about Azerbaijan. We're not talking about Tajikistan, because those are Asiatic countries. Those are Muslim countries. Those are countries that the people in power in the North, the Americans, the Europeans, those are countries that they want to keep out of the European Union. So we're talking about a massive amount of people in Europe over the next period. And that will make a big difference in the whole way in which the world is governed. I believe that the new European Union is setting itself up as a fortress Europe, that it's building a wall, not a physical wall at the moment, but it's building a wall around itself. And it is saying that we will keep out those people from Africa, from North Africa, we'll keep out refugees from whichever country they come from. And I believe that those that we are seeing the birth of a fortress Europe, which the like of which has never been seen before. And I think that if you want to test that theory, you only have to listen to the discussions and the debates that go on in Parliament and within the European Parliament and within Europe as a whole. And when you listen to those debates, we begin to see that what is envisaged is a Europe where people of color will be virtually excluded, where people of color will be sidelined, I believe, where the doors will be firmly shut on those people of color who wish to enter Europe. And of course, when we're talking about Europe, we're talking about countries who have long had traditional links with countries in Africa, in the Caribbean, and in Asia. And I think that when you talk about Britain, we talk about the Commonwealth, and we see the moves already taking place by the British government to cut off their links with the Commonwealth. If you look at the position in the Caribbean, Belize, a country which the British has had a garrison in order to protect it from Guatemala, an old British colony, the British government is pulling out all its troops and possibly will be leaving those countries to the whims of the Guatemalans. We see other countries in the Caribbean dependent territories. We see those countries, one by one, Britain either pulling out or putting up such a regime, a harsh, old-fashioned colonial type regime, that those countries will soon say, well, we better take independence because we don't want to be governed in this way. We have seen countries in the Eastern Caribbean, countries that have traditionally supported the British in everything, countries that have provided fresh fruit, produce for this country, being cast aside by the British government. So that countries like Dominica, countries like St. Lucia, St. Vincent, Grenada, countries that have traditionally supplied fruits, bananas and other fruit like that to this country are now being sidelined. And that is a part of the racism that is occurring in Britain. That is a part of the move towards the new Europe. So that the British government sells out all those Eastern Caribbean countries on their banana regime and on the banana protocol. Britain has traditionally accepted bananas at a higher price from those countries than the rest of the countries in the world, particularly Latin American dollar bananas. And as a part of the GATT negotiations, Britain has virtually sold out those countries so that those countries are now facing ruin. These are countries that were previously colonies, got their independence, still tied to Britain through aid and trade, etc. These countries will now be cut loose to such an extent that a country like Dominica, 80% of its foreign exchange comes from the sale of bananas to Britain. That country will virtually be wiped out over the next few years as a result of the deals that Britain has now gone into. Britain is getting rid of all or most of the trappings of the old Commonwealth. The Commonwealth Institute, which is in London here in Knightsbridge, that is going to be closed by the British government. The Commonwealth Foundation and all these other places have already been closed. And that is a part of the change that is taking place within Europe. And that change has been guided by the European Union. So that, first of all, in the question of its relations with black countries, with countries in Africa, countries in the Caribbean, countries in Asia, we have seen and we're seeing a whole change in the whole way in which the government is operating and what the government, of course, wants to do. It wants to be able to move freely into Europe so that it will take its place with the rest of the European Union countries, but to the detriment of countries in the Commonwealth. And this move by the government, these changes that are taking place, as I said, they are all being, they have all commenced as a result of the European Union. Let's take the question of immigration, because that, of course, is a major issue. We never hear much about immigration, or we never used to hear much about immigration until election time, when the government usually played the race card. And they usually said, well, the Labour Party, if you let Labour in, if Labour gets into government, Labour will let all these foreigners in, they let all these blacks in, and this, that, and the other. So the government, particularly at crucial periods during the elections, will come out with the race card. But the immigration situation in Britain today is very serious. And the position that the British government is taking on immigration arises directly as a result of what is happening in Europe. And in Europe, we have seen a number of secret groups that have been meeting over the past 5 years. There's the Trevi group, the ad hoc group on immigration, there is the Schengen group, and they come out ever so often with various conventions, the Dublin Convention, and it's all about excluding people, particularly people of color, from Europe. Now, one of the latest things that the British government has introduced has been, of course, the Immigration and Asylum Appeals Act, which was introduced last year in the House of Commons. I sat on the committee for about 6 weeks, and we discussed the whole question of people coming into Britain. And it was quite clear what it was all about. The impetus was coming from Europe, particularly from France and Germany and Belgium. And what they said to the British was that you've got some very liberal immigration laws. I mean, I don't think that Britain has very liberal immigration laws. But they say you've got very liberal immigration laws. People have all sorts of rights. But we want you to change it, and this is what they did. First of all, they removed the rights of people who were coming into this country as visitors. They removed their rights to appeal against being excluded from Britain by immigration officers. This was a major right, because what it meant was that if people were coming, and the people who it affects are people from Jamaica, from the Caribbean, from the Indian subcontinent, and from Africa. If the immigration officer says, I'm not going to allow you into Britain because I don't like the look of you, well, that's all they have to say. Then they had a right to go to court, or they had a right to appeal against that decision which excluded them. The bill changed all of that. It removed the rights. So that when, in December of last year, when a plane load of Jamaicans came into Britain on a flight that was previously cleared by Britain, the immigration officers and customs, That flight was singled out, and that flight was steered into a particular part of the airport, and the people were treated in an abominable way, and they couldn't do anything about it because that right that they had of appeal had been taken away from them. So that we had a situation where some 300 people, a whole plane load, for the first time ever in known history, a whole plane load of people were stopped and arrested. All the white people were let off the plane. People who had black people with British passports were let off the plane. The rest of some 190 people were all taken into various police stations, detention centers. Some people were there for 2 or 3 days without food. They couldn't see their relatives, etc. They even, at the end of the day, when they sent a large number of the people back to Jamaica, they even sent back children, 2 and 3 years of age. And when we questioned the minister responsible for this abomination, Charles Wardrobe, he said, well, what were the ages of these children that you sent back? He admitted that some were 2 and 3 years old, some were 13 and 14. And they sent them back because, in the opinion of the immigration officers who questioned these children, in the opinion of the immigration officers, they were coming here because they intended to abscond and to run away and stay in Britain. Now, these are children aged 2, 3, 13, and 14. And, you know, it beggars belief, this sort of attitude. So, when we're talking about racism and the rise of racism in Britain, we're talking about the immigration situation. We're talking about the death of Joy Gardner, a 40-year-old Jamaican woman from my constituency, who was killed by immigration officers and the police SO13 squad from Scotland Yard that goes around deporting people. And this special hit squad in Scotland Yard that was set up was there to deport people who, in the opinion of the immigration officers, are troublesome or might give trouble. Because if you don't give trouble, they usually send Group 4 security or somebody like that to escort you to the, and you know, it's amazing the amount of money that is going, that is being paid out for these deportations. Amazing. Because not only do they have to pay for the passengers who are being deported, but they send 2 or 3 people to go along with them, to deliver them to their countries that they're being deported to. These people stay overnight in 5-star hotels, sometimes for 2 or 3 days. And I understand that the trip to Jamaica is a favorite trip. Because, of course, if you can escort someone to Jamaica for 2 or 3 days in a 5-star hotel, you could go and stretch out on Montego Bay or Ocho Rios and so on. So that the fellows are very keen to go on these particular trips. I speak in Croydon, and with the knowledge that ISIS house is just not far away, it's in the same road, I believe.
Yeah.
That's right, right here in Croydon.
Yeah.
And the thing about the Joy Gardner case, of course, is that not only was Joy Gardner killed, or she met her death at the hands of these people, we're now seeing a covering up of what actually happened. Because we're told that we cannot print, they cannot publish what has happened because the police officers might be charged with something or the other. Nobody assures us yet that anybody will be charged, or we can't have any discussion. We can't find out what's happening, so that the family, the relatives, the friends of Joy Gardner are sitting around in ignorance as to what is actually happening. So that racism in the immigration service is a major factor. During the course of our discussions and debates, I spoke for 3 hours on one day, because we tried to talk this bill out.
But of course, the government with its majority soon tightened up on the proceedings. And I talked for 3 hours, and I was prepared to talk for another six. But they eventually decided that if I spoke any longer, that they would close down the whole committee and everything would just be pushed through on the knot. So the Labour whips got to me and said, okay, Bernie, you better calm down and so on. And during that period, we were given information by bodies like the Commission for Racial Equality, who had done a survey, who had done an inquiry into the Immigration Service, and found a lot of racism. For instance, they quoted immigration officers who said that they can tell from the passengers that come off the plane which country they come from. They said the Nigerians are always very boastful and so on. The Ghanaians are a bit shy. And they have different characteristics that they gave to various black people as they came off the plane. And it was quite clear that they were making judgments on whether these people should be allowed in or not, just from the moment they stepped off the plane into the passenger, into the lounge, coming through, and so on. And some of the stories are absolutely amazing. I can spend another few hours telling you about them, but time forbids me from doing so. But some of the things that we uncovered were absolutely horrific. And that bill, the Immigration and Asylum Appeals Bill, is one of the worst bits of legislation ever to be passed in the British Parliament. Because not only does it deal with immigration, it deals with refugees. It starts off from the belief that refugees, Britain has to be protected from refugees. We can't have refugees here. So that refugees who are coming through have got to be fingerprinted, whether they're babies or whether they're elderly people, they have to be fingerprinted. They have to be questioned thoroughly. And any time they slip up, basically, it means that they cannot seek refuge in Britain. But it's worse than that, because the laws have been tightened up to such an extent that now refugees can't even come to Britain. That's why the 2 million refugees moving around in Bosnia-Herzegovina, we can't have more than 1,000 in Britain, because they can't get to Britain. Because they now have a new law that says that you cannot come to Britain and seek refuge. You can't seek refuge from your own country. You cannot come to Britain as a refugee either. What you've got to do is that you've got to apply to become a visitor and get a visitor's permit. So you get a visitor's permit and you come to Britain. And they say that when you're in Britain, you can then apply to become a refugee. But of course, they've also passed another law. We also passed another law in Parliament last year. And what that law basically said was that if you come to Britain, whatever you come as, you have to remain in that position. So that if you come as a visitor, you can then change your status to become a refugee. Or if you come as a student, you cannot then change your status to become a visitor or to apply to stay here for any length of time. You have to go back to your country of origin and then reapply and do the whole thing all over again. So with all this confusion, now we see why there are no Bosnians in Britain. I think at the last count, the minister said there were about 200 or 300 Bosnians allowed into Britain, because now Britain isn't taking refugees. Our doors are closed to refugees. And a lot of these policies have come directly from the European Union. In fact, the British government is downsizing its operations so that rather than Britain fight like the French do for their citizens, rather than Britain fight to raise the standards within the European Union, we have a position where Britain is going down to the lowest common denominator. And that is, of course, beginning to affect us. So immigration, the rise and the changes in the immigration system, those changes are amongst the most pernicious. And that is a clear rise in racism in Britain. We have also seen other difficulties. There's been a rise in racism and fascism in Europe. In all the European countries, we have seen fascist and racist organizations beginning to bloom. In Germany, the Republican and Homeland Party of Schoenhuber, ex-Waffen-SS, is now one of the most popular political parties in Bavaria. There was a poll in Germany the other day, and 80% of Germans said that they wanted all foreigners to leave Germany, including black people who are German, born in Germany and bred in Germany. And it's no wonder, because of course they say that if you're black, you're not German. And if you, for instance, if you're the product of a German woman and a black man, they say the German blood is tainted, so therefore you don't qualify. And we have this strange situation in Germany where ethnic Germans are coming from Russia and from other parts of the old Soviet Empire, speaking not a word of German, are being taught by Turkish and black Germans. And those people are more German than the people who are teaching them, who are born there, who actually know the language. It's one of those strange things that happens in Germany. So that there's been a tremendous problem in Germany, and we know about the position in Rostock and Solingen and Hoyerswerda, all these places where people have been assaulted and killed. We move to France, of course. Monsieur Le Pen and the Front National. Le Pen is a sophisticated racist. His racism is...
fascist bastard.
Well, his racism, I'll be more polite than you. His racism is cultural racism. Because he says, well, the real problems are the Arabs. The real problem is Islam. So that he has a war against the North Africans. He has a jihad against the North Africans. He's changed the whole thing all around. He says, well, West Indians, people from Martinique and Guadeloupe, well, they're not quite the same as us, but they're okay. By and large, they are French. They are black French, they have our customs and so on. The people that we're after are the Arabs. So that Le Pen comes with from a different position than Schoenhuber, for example, in Germany. But the effect is the same, that racism is rising rapidly in France, particularly in the south of France, around Marseille. In Belgium, the Flams Bloc Party, a Flemish nationalist party, a party that they don't even like French-speaking people, let alone people of color. So you can understand the sort of situation there is there. And of course in Italy, the Lega Lombardi, the MSI, and so on, have all grown tremendously. Even in Scandinavia, countries that have traditionally assisted the struggles of people, struggles of the ANC, SWAPO, struggles of black people around the world have been assisted by the Danes, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Finns. Even in those countries now, there have been huge changes and fascist organizations have sprung up all over the place. And of course, we have the position where the political leaders in these countries are taking on board what the fascists say. So that in Germany, as a result of pressure from Schoenhuber, the German government changes its constitution to stop the right of people to seek refuge in Germany. In France, the new government of Monsieur Balladur and his interior minister, Monsieur Pasqua, they've started a pogrom against so-called illegal immigrants. But the problem is that they don't know who is an illegal immigrant from who is a French citizen. And because black people are black people, we have the situation where blacks are being rounded up and being challenged, and they have to prove that they are legal, including blacks from Britain. And some of my constituents recently came to me because they went to France and they were stopped and interrogated for 4 hours by the French police. And people are saying when they produced their passport, they said, oh, where did you get this from? Who did you steal this from? I had a constituent who went to Denmark. They arrested her, they said she was a prostitute, and they put her on the plane to come back, no trial, no judge, no magistrate, nothing. Just on the basis that the person is black, and the police officer says, I think you're a migrant or you're an illegal immigrant, and I'm sending you back. And we have to take up these cases, of course, and we begin to fight those cases, so that when we see what's happening in these countries, when people talk about freedom of movement around Europe, they're not talking about the freedom of black people to move around Europe. They're talking about the freedom of white people to move around Europe. Because if you're black, because of those groups I mentioned earlier, like the Schengen group, the Trevi group, the ad hoc group on immigration, all those people have put out a stereotype of black people. If you're a woman, you're probably a prostitute. If you're a man, you're a gun runner, or you're a terrorist, or you're an illegal immigrant. So that the person in the border that they're looking at are black people, different shades of black, are associated with different criminal behavior throughout. So that we have a real difficulty as black citizens of Europe in establishing ourselves. You know, when I came here in 1960s, we had to fight the Teddy Boys and so on. We fought in Notting Hill, and we had to fight, and then things changed, and we made a bit of progress, and then we stopped the fight against people like the National Front and the British movement, and everybody thought that we made progress. We had a few councillors elected, the MP or two, and people thought, oh well, we're moving forward. But now we're finding that not only have we got to get back and defend ourselves in Britain, we have to defend ourselves in Europe as well. And of course, the situation in Britain itself is very serious. When our own Prime Minister, a man who claims to come from Brixton, not a million miles away from here, says he's a Brixton boy, when he gets up and makes all sorts of statements in the European context about blacks coming here and there are 8 million of them here at the moment, and this, that, and the other, I think that we have to be very concerned. And when we listen to the Prime Minister and we see what's happening in Britain, then I, for one, am extraordinarily concerned about the situation, because we're seeing now overt racism of the worst kind. When the British National Party councillor, Mr. Beckton, in the Beacon, when he was elected in Tower Hamlets, that was a signal to a lot of people that things have changed. And I believe that the whole way in which the election took place, the fact that people were intimidated, stopped from going to the polls by British National Party thugs in front of the police, in Tower Hamlets, in front of the police, shows you what the situation is. When the Asian youth tried to defend themselves, and we know that self-defense is legal and it's allowed within British law, and they tried to defend themselves against the attacks of these outsiders, these racists who've come into the neighborhood, we find that they themselves are arrested and the racists and the fascists are set free. We find that the whole area is organized in such a way that racism is allowed to flourish. And I believe that some people have got the direct responsibility for that. I think all the political parties have got a responsibility for what took place. And I believe that unless there is action taken by the political leaders, then I think that we'll be moving in Britain into a situation like the situation in Germany, or like applies in certain of the cities in France and in Belgium, where there are constant battles going on between young black people and the police. It goes on all the time. We don't even get it reported any longer because it is not seen as something out of the ordinary. Running battles almost every day going on in Belgium cities and in France. And I think that we are in danger of going down that particular road. And I think that when we look at the way in which the British government is treating this whole issue, one has to be seriously concerned. I believe, and I make no bones about it, that the British National Party should be banned, because that is a racist and a fascist party. It has no truck with democracy, and it is a nonsense for people to say, well, we will allow an undemocratic party, a party that openly boasts of violence and boasts that it is a racist party, and a party that has a program of repatriation, compulsory or voluntary, for people of color. I think that to allow such a party to act as if that party were a normal democratic party is an insult to people of color in particular. I think that the British government should take action, because everywhere the British National Party has been able to establish itself, to put up premises and to put out its literature, there have been murders, 12 racist murders in the last year, including murders in Greenwich, Roland Adams, Stephen Lawrence, stabbing of Kudus Ali. A whole number of people have been killed recently within the vicinity of the British National Party headquarters and in areas where there has been fascist and racist violence. So that I think that the organization should be banned. I think that the British government should set up a special squad of police officers that can concentrate solely on the question of racial harassment and racial violence. They should be like the GIs, you know, in America. You know, the government men, the G-men, not the GIs, sorry, the G-men. The all untouchables. I think that we should be in that position. We should set up a force of people, a national force, that can look at all the evidence that is around. Because we're talking about a situation in Britain in 1994. We're not only were there 12 racist murders last year, there were literally tens of thousands of racist attacks, thousands of cases of racial abuse and racial harassment, of daubings on people's walls, of pouring filth and petroleum through the letterboxes of people's homes and setting them alight. These crimes have risen tremendously, and we are seeing little or no movement in terms of the perpetrators being caught and being sent to prison and being dealt with seriously. So that I believe that we now have to demand certain things of the government. But we also have to demand things of the political leaders. We have to say to the leader of the Labour Party, Mr. Smith, it's about time that you started mentioning this question of race and what is happening to British citizens every day of the week. We have to urge him to do it, because the Labour Party is almost as bad, not quite, but almost as bad as the government in this particular matter. And we have to say to Paddy Ashton, well, by kicking out one or two people into our hamlets doesn't mean that your party has absolved itself and cleansed itself of racism. Because I know that in my area and in other areas where there have been black candidates, liberal Democrats have put up leaflets that always raise the question of race in all elections, almost all elections. I was speaking to one of my colleagues who won the by-election in Langbar. And he said that the Tories were quite reasonable on the doorstep, but the Liberal Democrats were terrible. And they all raised the fact that he was an Asian and questioned it and so on. So that I think that the political leaders have got to come out and say quite clearly where they stand on this issue. I also believe that other people, the church leaders, I think that other people of influence have got to take this question very seriously, because I think that if that isn't done, we are in danger of the next decade becoming a decade where the biggest problem in terms of society and in terms of the social issues will be the questions of race, of immigration, of refugees, etc. So that we'll all be looking in and fighting each other because someone is a bit lighter skinned or is white and someone is black. We will end up in that kind of situation where we're all fighting each other. And of course, once we fight each other, we have no time to see the problems that are occurring in terms of the economy, in terms of what's happening. Because let's not forget that this particular period, a period of recession, a period of unemployment, a period of bad housing, bad social issues, that it is particularly at this time that racists and fascists find their greatest recruiting grounds, because of course people are disillusioned, they're fed up with the major political parties, and people tend to move and to operate in ways that they wouldn't in times of plenty. So that this particular period has got to be the time when we take severe action. I want to wind up by saying to you that there are also other things that I haven't been able to touch on this evening. You've seen ministers talking about and raising issues of race that cause me concern. I heard Mr. Major the other day introducing the local government election period. And he said a number of things. And one of the things he said was that he compared Hackney in London to Haiti. Right? And then I heard Mr. Portillo, the man some call the Prince of Darkness, come on television and said that the debt, Camden's debt, is bigger than the debt of Chad in Africa. And I said to myself, what's going on? Why are these people raising these issues? Why is it that Mr. Major links Hackney with Haiti? Why is it that Mr. Portillo links Camden with Chad? It's obvious. It's obvious. They're sending subliminal racial messages. And I suspect that over the election period for the local government election and the European elections, we're going to see more of that. Because the government has nothing left. It's only got the race card to play. Because everything else has failed. It has failed miserably in terms of the economy. It has failed in terms of employment. It has failed in terms of the health service. It has failed in terms of every single issue that is of importance to British people. The government has failed on. So in those circumstances, I put to you that the government will fall back on an old favorite, the race car, and they'll use it, of course, in the local elections. So that I believe we have to be vigilant. And I believe that we have to try and take steps during the local election and the European election to try and expose this any sort of racism that comes to the fore. I believe that we should, for example, ask all candidates to sign a declaration to say that they will not indulge in racism during the election campaign, or they will not support anyone in their party or outside who comes up on a racist, who runs on a racist ticket. I believe that if you can get that in Croydon, we are fighting to get it in Aragon. If we can get that kind of commitment from the candidates, then I believe that we will be in a position where we might at least be able to fight back against the forces of racism that are there and around us. Having said all this, I am eternally an optimist. I'm not pessimistic at all, because I believe that people of goodwill exist in whatever country, and that they are in the majority. Those forces who are going to be there to support people who are oppressed, people who are in struggle, I think that those forces are there. But we need to mobilize them. And I want to end by saying to you that I believe that despite all the things I've said, despite all the problems I've raised, despite the situation I've described in Europe, etc., I still believe that the position in Britain is far superior to the position in the rest of Europe. And when you speak to black people in Europe, they also tell us the same thing. They say to us, we wish we had the laws that you have here. We wish we had the Commission for Racial Equality. We wish you had, we had black members of parliament or black councillors to go to. We are unable to do so. So that we have to keep up our, we have to remain in front. And I would say to any Labour government that will come in, and I'm sure Labour will come into power, that when you go to Europe, you have to do the reverse of what the Conservative government is doing. You have to fight for your black citizens. Because when you fight for the most oppressed, when you fight for black people, you're fighting for working class people. You're fighting for people of people who are oppressed all around the country. Because if black people are at the bottom of the ladder, and if we can fight to get them to move one rung up the ladder, then everybody else above them also moves up one rung in the ladder, apart from everything else. So I believe that we will see a change in Britain. But I believe that change will come only when the Labour government is elected. And I hope that you will be there alongside with me, fighting to ensure that we do have the return of a Labour government, that we're able to see an end not only to the poverty and deprivation that pervades at the moment, but an end to racism in all its forms. Thank you very much.